This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the show. Our guest tonight is John Stansfield, and he's head of the social practice at Unitech. We'll be joining him by phone later on. And our show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. And this is our first show of the year, and it's our first live show for a wee while. And we're back in the studio, and it's great to be back here. And so I'm going to start off with my number of the week, which is 27. And that's 27 square kilometers of solar farm, which is the biggest in the world. And it's built in the Tibetan plateau. And it's called Longyangzha Dam Solar Park. And I'm sure I've just completely mangled that name. In the western province of Qinghai in China. And it is a part of an ever-expanding roll of call of supersized symbols that underlying China's determination to transform itself from a climate villain to a green superpower. And I'm sure many of us have seen the recent reports of incredible levels of pollution around some of the major Chinese cities this winter. Now, this plant has been built at a cost of about 6 billion yuan, and that's 721 million pounds sterling, or $1.2 billion New Zealand. And it is almost in constant expansion, because it's not just a single project. They keep building more and more of it. And it's began in 2013, and it now has the capacity to produce a massive 850 megawatts of power, and that's enough to supply about 200,000 households. And it stands at the front line of the global photovoltaic revolution being spearheaded by China. Now, as recently as 2012, China had dismissed solar power as being too expensive, but no more, as costs have since plummeted. And by 2020, China, which is now the world's top clean energy investor, hopes to be producing 110 gigawatts of solar power and 210 gigawatts of wind power as part of an ambitious plan to slash pollution and emissions. And by 2050, China has pledged to increase the amount of energy coming from non-fossil fuels to 20% of the total. So that's my number of the week, which is 27 square kilometers of solar farm. And Sam, what have you been thinking about? What's your thought for today?
Well, as you mentioned, we started the show in 2011. We started with Jinty McTavish was the first one. And this is then our seventh year of doing this. And I think one of the most insightful things that we do, maybe not that we do, but the most insightful answers that we get, are to the question about activism. We ask people, do they consider themselves an activist, and then pause a bit and make them explain why. And I've been thinking about that in lieu of what's going on in the States at the moment, because of what's going on in the States at the moment. And I read an interesting tweet this morning that said, whoever would have thought that the resistance would be begun by the social media managers of the National Park Service. And it's really got me thinking about what is the role of any of us to do our jobs and to stand up and to talk about the stuff that we're supposed to be talking about, even when, in that case, a government changes and all of a sudden they don't want to hear that. And should we carry on doing that? And what's the role of that? Last year I talked to Alison Druin, who is the she seconded to a position looking at the digital strategy for the National Parks Service. And she did talk about the sort of the roles of the people doing this work. There's somebody that's in one of the visitor centres, each of the visitor centres for the national parks, and they've got a really hard job of sort of combing through the sort of science news and making it relevant to come and visit our park. This is how this particular bit of science affects this particular park, and then linking that backwards and forwards. And all of a sudden, doing that very thing is deemed to be, we don't know yet, but possibly a sackable offence. And that's just sort of like weird and really puts into perspective the answers that we get to that question about activism.
Yeah, I suspect that, I mean, just speaking to people back in America that we were friends, you know, I've got in-laws there and friends there, and suddenly people who would never expect to become activists are suddenly realizing, oh, we have to do something. This is, what's happening is terrible. I mean, and I saw a tweet, you know, first they came for the Muslims, the Latinos, the scientists, the journalists, and then it was Wednesday. I mean, the thing was just suddenly just this broad-based attack on the basis of reality, and it's really, really frightening. And I think people have been shocked into activism, and I think people are going to have to start thinking about what they do and what it means to be a citizen in your own country.
Yeah, I think it's probably worthwhile us reviewing some of those answers that we've got to what people have said about that, and, you know, perhaps making some statements about, you know, that people think this is important, but some people really are quite hesitant to do it, and this is their reasons why they mm-hmm. might not feel comfortable doing it, and this is the reasons why some people say, absolutely, this is why I do it. Remember, Sir Alan Mark said, I'm an activist because I have to be. It's part of the job.
Yes. And we live, as Chinese say, in interesting times. All right, I think we have a quick word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So John Stansfield is head of the Department of Social Practice at Unitech in Auckland, where they teach undergraduate and postgraduate programs in community development, as well as social work and counselling. He's worked extensively in community development in his own community, as well as Palmerston North, Papua New Guinea, and other Pacific Islands. And he's one of the founders of the graduate programs of the NGO Management Department, NGO Management at his university. Welcome to our show, John. Now, can
well,
you hear us?
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and kia ora otago.
Kia ora. So what we're going to do, what we normally do, we start off with a little bit about your past. So where were you born, John?
Well, I was born at a tragically early age in Auckland, and I grew up initially in Te Aratu, which is a glorious suburb on the harbour, in the upper harbour. I went to school there and lived there until I was about 10 or so, when my parents had some kind of crazy idea and moved us to the Bible Belt of Mount Roskill, which amongst the many facilities it didn't even have a pub. So I became bored with that quite quickly, and at 18 I decamped and went and lived in the bush in Papua New Guinea for 18 or 20 months or so. And as far as growing up, I'm still doing it. It's been a long and difficult childhood.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, goodness, retired.
So you went to Papua New Guinea, and then you came back to New Zealand, obviously, at some point. Yes. And so what brought you back, and what did you decide, you know, what did you learn in Papua New Guinea? And
Papua New Guinea was a transformative experience. I went there in 1976. It was a newly independent country. I, in fact, tried to go in 75 just as it became independent, but they didn't have embassies and you couldn't get visas, and it was terribly difficult. But I got there, and I worked as a motor mechanic and training other people in small engines in the bush in what's now called Sundown Province, which was then the West Sepik, as a volunteer, and lived very simply in villages, met all kinds of fabulous, fabulous characters, and the land of the unexpected, as they call Papua New Guinea, has a way of seeping into you and calling you back. And I think I've been back more than 20 times since I left. I was fortunate enough, in fact, to go back and do some teaching up there, and then later to go back and do some work for Oxfam. So it's a fabulous, fabulous country.
What first got you interested in going to, you know, Papua New Guinea? Because, I mean, that's not a standard path. I mean, most people, when they're 18, head off to Europe or America. Why PNG? And
well, in common with most 18-year-old males, it was not a rational decision. I think it was something which came about as an argument in a pub about whether I should join this movement to not have beer and pies on a Friday and put the money into aid and development. And being fond of beer and pies, as my girth will tell you, I had to argue against it. I'll actually argue against just about anything. And say that I'd far rather do something more practical with my skills. And somebody called my bluff and said, look, actually, there's this unpaid job in the bush in a mosquito-infested hellhole. And the West Sepik has the best mosquitoes in the world. They need clearance from civil aviation to land. You know, they frequently make off with calves and small children. And so my bluff was called and I couldn't back out and I went.
So that must have been an amazing experience. And so you're extremely fond of the country and the people. So you came back to New Zealand, and what was your plan when you came back? Did you have a plan? Or?
Well, by then, actually, sitting around in the bush with not too much to do but chew betel nut and occasionally get a bit of wireless, you get a bit of time to think, and I decided that I really wanted to come back and study social work, but particularly what I thought was community social work, which turned out to be community development. And just for readers who aren't familiar with the term, I think of it as community development is the crucible of democracy. It's the place where citizens come together to share their dreams and plan their common futures. So it's a way of collectively organising to make life better. And that became my discipline, and I've kept it for the rest of my life, and something I'm enormously fond of and very proud of, and which defines me. So, you know, these days I'm a senior lecturer in community development, having become too old for useful work. I've returned to academia, where it's no object to advancement. But I've been, I'm on the board of the International Association of Community Development, and I'm chairing the Aotearoa Association and chairing the National Conference, and I've been fortunate enough to go off to, I did a tour in March last year through India with 20 other community development practitioners, and it's fabulous. It's better than religion.
But community development obviously is different depending on what communities you're in. So if, you know, if community in Papua New Guinea might be different to what we would consider a community here or in Ireland or in India or Pacific. I mean, what are the common themes, and what are the differences, and what do you have to be, you know, careful of as going in, you know, as a foreigner?
Well, the great trap in community development is you really can't have much of an agenda of your own. You've got to help people find the agenda that they want. And to give you an example, I chair a fabulous little organisation called the Waiheke Resources Trust, which is www.wrt.org. It does all kinds of fabulous projects in community development. We got a little grant out of council to see whether we could do something about food waste. Now, almost all the work that's done on food waste is done after you've wasted the food. It's a deeply stupid place to intervene in a problem. And myself and a young colleague intern wrote a paper doing a lit review from around the world on food waste and said, you've got to start somewhere else. So we put this thing through to Ministry for the Environment, and they were pretty excited about it, and then they had a change of leadership, and no one was very excited again, and we pitched away and did a little trial at home, and ultimately we got the local council to say, yeah, look, we'll put some money behind you, go and see what you can do. And they sent us off to a fabulous community we chose on what he called Blackpool. And Blackpool has a residents association which exists under the name BRA, the Blackpool Residents Association. It came together when the community was flooded some years earlier. And it had been kind of a little bit in abeyance. So we got that community together and we said, let's spend an afternoon dreaming about what we'd really like in this community. And I kept in the background of it, and we had a couple of young women, one of whom was working for us and one of whom was working for council, in facilitating this process. And I said, that's good, we've got all your ideas, we're going to write them up, we're going to bring you back, and John will cook you a lovely three-course dinner with wine and candles and everything, and then we'll narrow it down and we'll come up with what we're going to do. Now, what we were wanting to do was to inject some enthusiasm around sustainability and food waste. What the residents came up with is that they really wanted a pub. And I thought, well, fantastic. I can go back to the council and say, Mr. Mayor, look, thanks very much for your money. Got nowhere on the sustainability, but the residents would like a pub, preferably on your land. Now, this could be a severely career-limiting approach. But actually, we worked with that community, and they've got a pub. It's a fantastic thing. It's called the Dog and Pony, and it pops up. It's a pop-up pub. It pops up in a public building every few weeks, and people bring their biscuits and their nibbles and their bottle of wine or their homemade beer and their violin, and they have a fabulous time in their own community, and they walk to it and walk home. No one gets killed in the process. But you can see that, the purpose of that story is to illustrate how it's actually got to be the community's decision what they want. Having got that and had the pub delivered, we were able to see who leaders were in that community and get alongside them and say, look, can we do something around food waste? And we did a fantastic trial in there and really significantly reduced the waste of food and learned a whole lot that we're now rolling out in other communities.
Is that easier or harder on an island?
Oh, it's much easier on an island. Everything's easier on an island. Well, not everything, actually. We've run out of water here, so that's not easier. But you can, your relationships are far more intimate. Everybody's recycled. And you have to be a little bit more both self-reliant and collectively reliant on each other to make things work. And so that there's an opening. And I think on this island there's a very proud history of concern about the environment and of being unafraid to stand up and be counted on things. We were the first place in New Zealand to be nuclear free. I think we were the first council to declare ourselves GE free. When the boats left for Mururoa, largely came from Waiheke. We're a great bunch. It's very easy to find other people of like mind in this community to do something that's better for everyone.
But then you have a council that is representing all of Auckland and does things like destroys your waste management system.
You've got the time sense of a geologist to appreciate these things, you see. We originally had a couple of roads boards here, and that then got made into the Waiheke County Council. And I remember the Waiheke County Council very fondly, a place where politics became a blood sport and source of local entertainment, where people jostled to get a seat at the local council meeting, trying deftly to be upwind of Fred Borrock, who hadn't washed, where at one stage half the county went to jail for smuggling, where they did things like say, well, it's our island and we're going to green it. And they built their own nursery, employed four or five islanders, and every ratepayer could front up and get three trees any time they liked. So you get your fruit trees, and fruit trees were planted on the road verges and, in public parks and all over the place. That was fabulous. And then it was compulsorily amalgamated with Auckland City Council, which is no longer. And Waiheke revolted, of course, because the first thing that the good burghers of Rocky Bay knew about the amalgamation as they came down their muddy track with their carefully sorted recycling was a big flash new council truck came past and threw the whole lot into a compactor and took it off to a hole in the ground. And so we're pretty vexed and aggrieved about that. When the Royal Commission on the Governance of Auckland asked the then 1.4 million people of the region to comment on their plan, 28.8% of all submissions came from the 0.8% of the people who lived on Waiheke, who demanded that the Commission come here and explain themselves about how we were going to do without local governance. And so ourselves and the Great Barrier community won their own kind of local governance back. And yes, it's true that we did lose our fabulous social enterprise in rubbish, but we'll win it back. We're like the widgery, we can rate.
So it sounds like there was already kind of a community there to work with. How do you develop a community where the one kind of doesn't already exist, or it's very fragile?
Oh, there's been some great work done around that in New Zealand and overseas. In fact, I had a cup of tea this morning with my very good friend, Gavin Rennie, who's just at 76, just retired from being a senior lecturer in community development. He was the first local authority community worker employed in New Zealand. They put him in the new Nappy Alley suburbs of Massey out in the West Auckland. And when he finished his term, they didn't appoint a new one, the council, because they had so much trouble with the last one. Because he just very patiently went round getting to know people, linking people up, getting conversations going about things. Similarly, a great New Zealand community worker was Wendy Craig, who worked in the Takaro community of Palmerston North and was very famous there when the hospital board were considering closing a maternity unit. Wendy got a whole bunch of mothers with crying babies to go to the hospital board meeting. I think there was a bit of judicious bottom pinching during the meeting, because the meeting had to be abandoned. There were so many crying babies that the board got the message they shouldn't really mess with the woman of Takaro. So it's a gentle process of getting to know people, finding their interests, linking them up with each other, making it possible for people to believe that they can control their own futures and have a say. And once you get to that point, it's pretty unstoppable.
We visited Oamaru last year or the year before, who have got a really, really strong transition towns movement.
Oh, yes.
They've got a really good summer school, and they've got the waste system, I've come over it's called.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they're planting trees on every street front, and just a whole pile of things. And we thought, this is amazing. We have to go and find out how they're managing this. How is the whole town in behind transition Oamaru? And it turns out it's not. There's about six people doing everything. But what they're doing is doing things that other people can get engaged in.
Yeah.
And even if they think that the transition town people are a bit weird, they still recognise that having fruit trees in front of their house is a good thing.
Yes, yes, yes. Those transition towns, it's a bit like a brand, really. I mean, they came to Waiheke, and the next thing we noticed was all kinds of things we'd already been doing were transition town things, you know. But that's good. They're able to reach, I think, a different constituency. And so, you know, every little tribe that marches in a similar direction, that reaches a new constituency, makes us all collectively stronger. So it's great. Kaikoura is another place that's fabulous. Kaikoura, you know, my wife was down there last week helping sort the rubbish on the line in their recycling plant, because her brother Robbie Roach is the manager of Innovative Waste Kaikoura, and of course they're facing a mountain of construction and demolition waste, and working out how as a community they can make the best of that. They're wonderful. There's a lot to be said for rubbish. I've started to think that we've got to grab hold of all the rubbish and keep it for the poor before the rich find out how bloody valuable it is.
Well, I wrote a blog post once about the one time I visited Waiheke, and there was the rubbish was like sitting in a some sort of carton or big crate thing on the wharf, and I thought that's a really good, you know, all the people that get off the wharf can see this is the result of our throughput. It's invisible. You don't need to have a website or anything, but unfortunately that's gone. My question though was the. Is there a tipping point of how much community engagement you need to actually make a difference?
Well, if I refer back to my good friend Wendy Craig, who's a very wise woman, and she said once, if you're fun to be with, there'll always be people with you. And so two essential ingredients for good community development are fun, coupled with a deep sense of irreverence, and food. And if you put those two things together, you can find ways to build bridges and get people kind of engaged. And once people become engaged in their own neighbourhood, and there's oodles of research out that says people want to be more engaged and they want to do that locally, somewhere where they live. We just seem to have built a social structure that's going in entirely the wrong direction for that. If some clever marketing guru gets hold of it, there'll be community development on sale. So I suppose there is a kind of tipping point, but it's a tipping point of one. You know, it just takes a little bit of enthusiasm in pulling people together, and it has its successes and its failures, and it requires some judicious thinking about what would be good early successes, because nothing succeeds like success. People's experience of a win is very empowering.
You've written about thorny issues. You write about gambling and the effect, the relationship between gambling and public health. What's the crossover between that and the collective organising and community development we've been talking about?
Oh, sure. Well, I this is my second stint in academia. I was there in the mid-90s, and I founded a graduate program in not-for-profit management because I started to wonder. I actually wondered this on a beach with a great American guy called Tim McMaines. We sat on a beach and wondered this together, whether the biggest threat to biodiversity was not the loss of Hotchester's frog or the Maui dolphin, but the most important biodiversity was a biodiversity of thought. And what I observed happening around the world in terms of governance and management was that there was starting to be a kind of a one true solution, one size fits all. And funnily enough, it happened to be the one that culturally suited white men in suits from Boston. And so you saw other ways of doing and knowing and thinking being kind of pushed out to the margins. And when I looked at the impact of that on the community sector, I became deeply concerned at the kind of corporatization that was happening all over the place that was actually driving out the most important thing we do in the community organization, which is giving people the opportunity to belong. And belonging is just like really important for people and for healthy societies. And if you don't think it's important, go to court on a Monday morning. You're not going to find many place center mums, you know. So we sort of started to think about this thing about actually, you know, the way we manage community organisations has to be palpably different. It has to have its own co-pupper. It has to have its own culture. It has to have a consistency. But because you don't have the same tools, you don't have the same money that you can incentivise, and you don't have the legislative power of the state, all you have is trying to get people to line up around some values. So I did that for 9 years, and then I did a dangerous thing and had a holiday, and I woke up from there and thought, geez, I wonder if I'll still be here preaching on like this in 30 years' time. I should go and find out if it works. So I looked for a broken community organisation, which was the Problem Gambling Foundation, and I was fortunate enough to be appointed their CEO, and I had a really fantastic 5 years learning about gambling and its impact. And my thinking is very influenced by the late, great Bill Mollinson, who developed permaculture, and I'm sure some of your listeners will know about Bill and he and David Holmgren's work. But when I got to the Problem Gambling Foundation, things were quite broken. So I couldn't, like, hop into the truck and blast off into the sunset because none of the gears worked and the wiring was buggered and, you know, the finance system didn't work, and it was just a bloody mess. So it was a lot of kind of grunt work to be done for about 3 months. And while I was doing that, I decided I'd have a master's level education in gambling. So every night I would read 2 or 3 hours worth of papers from around the world about gambling. What I quickly found out is that more than half of them had all of the validity of 1950s tobacco research, and for exactly the same reason. Just as the tobacco companies corrupted the research sector by buying it, so had the gambling industry. And that really kind of made it hard, you know, because I didn't know. I didn't know what the answer was. So I had to keep looking, keep looking, keep looking. One night about 10 o'clock, I came across one statistic, and it showed me that 10 years earlier, no New Zealand women had had come to treatment for gambling problems. And yet now, in 2003, this was, more than half the people coming were women. Now, if you approach that bit of statistic with the traditional addictions lens, and addictions looks at the person who is harmed after the harm has happened and says, what is the matter with the person? Then the question you ask is, what happened to New Zealand women that they all got so weak over 10 years? Now, mine has not been a life which has been surrounded by weak New Zealand women. I tend to end up with the very kind of mouthy, stroppy ones. But there's still time. It's a species I'm interested to explore. And so I thought, this just doesn't make bloody sense. Now, I fell back on my my trade union background. I thought, now, if I'd gone to a mill and there were three blokes sitting around with their arms cut off, my first thing wouldn't be to get them into a support group and say, now, come on, you fellows, what happened in your earlier lives that caused you to cut your arms off? But essentially, that's what we were doing with gamblers. We were getting people who were coming who were deeply harmed and saying, this is your fault in some way. And it isn't. The normal outcome of regular use of a pokie machine is that you'll be harmed by it. It's a deeply, deeply pernicious industry, and it extracts money out of the communities can least afford it. If you follow the capital flows, it's a transfer of wealth from the women to the men, from the brown to the white, and from the poor to the rich. And once I understood that, I knew that it was deeply offensive, and I could have a great deal of fun fighting it. And it's just like any other kind of plunder, environmental plunder or community plunder.
Why has New Zealand society allowed that or constructed, you know, a system? Because this kind of gambling, for instance, isn't legal back in Ireland. And I was really shocked when I came over here to see, like, the pokie machines and the casinos. It's like, what allowed that? What was the construct there?
Well, I've always wondered in Ireland whether the reason it didn't go ahead because the church couldn't find a way to control it. Just as an aside. But the way gambling gets in everywhere, they've got a standard method, and it's lies, deception, and corruption. And they have fantastic relationships with senior people in government. I can think of a fellow in a one-man party, and I don't mean David Seymour, who in his entire career in politics has never voted against the gambling industry, the liquor industry, or the tobacco industry, and he stands for a Family First Party, so think about that. they use all kinds of chicanery in communities, and they have got oodles and oodles of money. I often used to say any idiot could run a pokie trust, and usually does.
But what do you do about trying to change that behaviour? If you're taking that sort of collective responsibility role that you were sort of talking about, the point is that it's already normalised.
It is, yeah. But people aren't stupid. In fact, what you see happening with the pokie industry up until the last two quarters is a poisoning of the well, where there's very few people in this country now who don't know somebody or some family that's been blighted by those machines. It's really, really hard to walk into anywhere where they are and imagine that there's something glamorous going on. And all you really have to do to fight against it is, number one, tell the truth. And we tell the truth about it on a daily basis through a news feed called Today's Stories that a wonderful woman named Donna in Auckland puts together every morning and gets on my desk about 7 a.m. and it's a summary of all the gambling stories in New Zealand and around the world. And you find things like, you know, the second biggest motivator for organised fraud, you know, a white-collar crime, and this is a top accounting firm study, is gambling. Unless you look at the charitable sector alone, in which case it's always the highest motivator. You know, so gambling's only allowed in our society really for charitable purposes, but the people most likely to get harmed by it are charities. and when you start to tell that story repeatedly, it starts to become true. So the latest surveys by the Department of Internal Affairs now show that the majority of New Zealanders don't think it's a good idea to fund communities out of the gambling industry. And while the Minister Dunn, is desperately trying to liberalise the regime and ensure that poker machines are a sustainable industry, you can't put glitter on a turd. You know, it just isn't going to work. Ultimately, people will throw them out. And I think we will look back on this period of our history with a sense of deep shame and say, how did we allow that level of exploitation of our poorest and most vulnerable citizens? Because make no mistake, it's the poor who pay the price for pokie gambling. I put a picket on a pub in Manurewa a few years ago, and they had $5.1 million in that poor, poor, poor South Auckland suburb leave town. And some of the money went to charity. It went to the Otago Rugby Union somebody in Canterbury, I think it was the Canterbury Jockey Club, the horse owners, which is apparently is a sport. None of it went, not one red cent of it went back into that community, and yet there were mums dropping the kids off at school in their dressing gowns, coming into that pub, playing those machines, desperate to try and win some of it back.
Talking about stories and telling the truth, I'm thinking about now as we move very quickly into what's being referred to as post-truth. But we've been having the same thing on a lesser level for quite a long time here about the story that it's all right, Jack. Everything's wonderful on Planet Key. Is that making it harder to engage communities because they're being told so strongly that everything's all right?
There is certainly something very comforting about the news, according to Mike Hoskins, it doesn't really bear looking at. And you know, put it in context to the States. I was in the States during the period of the conventions, and I just couldn't believe it. You know, it was like, hey, come on, you people, you're not stupid, are you? What's going on? You wonder how long it will be before working class, particularly working class male America, wakes up and realises they've seriously been duped. There is, I think, a real risk in our society in the decline in journalism, and I don't mean that our journalists are any less than they ever were. There's great journalists in this country, but there's a hell of a lot less of them, and they've got a hell of a lot less time to do their job. So there's a lot of stuff that is just sliding by. I just about fell off the chair when I read that we were the least corrupt country in the world.
You've written about gagging, I think, in relation to Christchurch. Do you think we've got a problem with people in government, local government, national government, being told what they can and can't say?
Oh, yes, we have, and it gets passed down. So that one of the real roles of the community sector and community development organisations is to get people together and speak on their behalf. And what we've seen with the rise of contractualism and the relationship between government and the community sector is that those contracts are used to exercise gagging and changes in governance and all manner of restrictions. I remember at the Problem Gambling Foundation getting told that we provide free counselling services in prison, that we would not be able to have a contract if we continued to provide free counselling services in prison. Now, our organisation was actually born in prison, when a couple of guys who realised they were in prison because of their gambling decided they were going to do something about it. So we have very deep roots to that. And I said to the officials at the time, well, hell will freeze over, guys. Let's see who's going to blink first. And we were a long time, many, many, many months with no income, staring down the barrel of that, saying you can't withhold medical treatment, which is what counselling service is, from people in prison. That's in breach of international human rights codes, and we won't participate with it. But boy, did that organisation get punished by the Ministry of Health for having an ethical position. They certainly did. But they've still got that ethical position, I'm proud to say.
But do other organisations look at that example and then think, we better not cross the government?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Of course they do. And a terribly expensive case for, you know, for an organisation to have to take with, you know, all the brilliant work that was done by a fantastic team of lawyers. But by golly, it didn't come cheap just to preserve what you already had.
So there is the, so what we're saying is what we're seeing in happening in America in a very, very radical, you know, in a very problematic, you know, very clear way, has been happening slowly here for a long time.
Yes, I do think there's some of that, but I also think that we owe it to our communities not to be timid, you know, and not to self-censor. I can put up with being censored by the state. I can rebel against it. I can speak out against it. But I'm far more worried about people doing the nervous Nelly and self-censoring, to please.
You're head of the Department of Social Practice.
I was head of the department. I'm happily now. poor Robert Ford has that honour. I'm now a senior lecturer in community development.
Okay, but you're teaching people how to be community development practitioners.
Yes.
Are you training them to be troublemakers?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. We're training them to be true. To stand, to look at injustice and impoverishment and know where they're going to stand. But, you know, really, they are the most delightful students. I had, it must have been 2015, I think, I had a student come into my office breathlessly and say, I've done something. And I said, well, that's good, we've all done something. What is it you've done? I can't even tell you. She passed me her phone and she'd set up a Facebook page to plan a protest on TV3 about the proposed closure of Campbell Live. And I said, well, that's fantastic. It's terrific. We'll talk with the class about it. She said, but I've never been to a protest before. I said, oh, well, that's fine. We'll have a look on the computer. We'll find you one to go to. And so a group of them went off down and helped the McDonald's workers fight the good fight against 0 hours contracts. And then they led a protest march to TV3 and they got inside and occupied the building and had a wonderful time. Sat on the floor and slapped their thighs and said, this is what democracy looks like. And I was terribly, terribly proud of them because that's how you build a people who will not be bowed. And the risk that we have all around the world at the moment is that governments lose the understanding that they govern by consent and that consent can be withdrawn.
But those young graduates of yours,
yes,
the ones you've trained to be troublemakers, they have to go into organisations that rely on government funding.
They do. So, they do. Oh, yes.
So how are they going to manage that tension?
Life's full of difficulties, isn't it? I talked to one just the other day who did a TV show by posing as a school child and buying single cigarettes. She's happily found work in a tobacco control agency. I think young people are actually pretty smart. And what I observe happening around the place is some very good advocacy training is going on. I went out on Saturday night and I met Sandy, the producer of the documentary Beautiful Democracy, which is about the young people who led the TPPA protest. And, oh gosh, my heart was so warmed by the fact that these young people were really deeply thinking about their tactics and what would work and trying things out and you know, doing fantastic research and really deeply engaging in the society, because engaged citizens aren't the ones you've got to fear. It's the ones who aren't engaged you've got to be worried about.
Now, you are chairing, I think, the Community Development Association conference coming up in a couple
of
weeks.
I am, yes. It's a fantastic honour, actually. I'm thrilled to bits.
So what sort of things can we expect? I should say I'm going to it.
Oh, wow. It's going to be fantastic. It really is. We've got, as of this afternoon, I know 170-odd people from around the world coming. And what we're doing is we're using a community development lens So by and large, the people are coming are community activists, community development practitioners, and academics and leaders. And we're using that to look at the United Nations Agenda 2030, which is the Goals for Sustainable Development. And ordinarily, if you wanted to talk about the United Nations, you know, you put me into a deep sleep instantly. But the 17 Goals for Sustainable Development are a 15-year plan for the whole world, and they are just about the most important things that we could be dealing with. So, you know, it's ending poverty, it's ending hunger, it's about having gender equality, it's about having good health care, it's about having good education, and other things that you wouldn't expect, like access to clean and affordable energy. And one of the guys who's coming is Kellyanne Paul, who's from Raniket up in Uttarakhand in the foothills of the Himalayas. And I went up and visited him. And he works with these forest dwellers and people who live in the deep, deep valleys. And we were talking about Agenda 2030, which brings together a lot of social goals with a lot of environmental goals. And he said to me, look, it was inevitable. This is completely inevitable. We've known this would happen. Well, how do you bloody know that, sitting up here? And he said, look, you can't protect a forest if the people have no fuel for their cooking. You simply can't do it. So the only way we've managed to protect all this beautiful forest is by addressing the problem. And that is by, so they built small-scale biogas plants in each house that take the cow dung and human dung and produce gas, which does the cooking and lighting in the houses, so they don't need to walk miles into the forest and cut the trees down. Then you can protect the forest. You know, so very practical solutions, but based on some really good deep thinking and this wonderful confluence of the social and the economic and the environmental. It's a really exciting time because many people in community development actually have got a huge contribution to make to the way we take this stuff forward. Big companies are looking at this stuff. You know, one of the big multinationals, I can't remember exactly the name, but they probably made your toothpaste and soap this morning. They have so many tens of thousands that they give out in grants, and they have so many thousand days a year of corporate volunteering. And they just announced Agenda 2030, as of June, all of our volunteering, all of our donations and everything are going to be targeted on the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and all of our industries are going to be measured against their contribution to those goals. This is really big, big, big stuff.
All right. We're running out of time, and I've got seven questions to
I'll try to and be ask. Brief for
So us. We're going to have to rattle through them. What is your go-to definition of sustainability?
No pass. I haven't got a short one for that. But the traditional Brundtland Commission, which is to consume today only so much as to ensure tomorrow can, is still pretty good.
That'll do. How would you describe your sustainable superpower? What is it that you're bringing to the good fight?
Oh, a really good sense of fun, a deep reverence for food, and a great love of people.
I think I know what you're going to how you're going to answer this next question. But do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Absolutely. Activism is the rent you pay, the rent price that you pay for living on a planet.
Have you always thought that?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. My mum would say so. She said I was this troublesome in primary school.
Have you ever been in a position where you couldn't be?
I've often been in a position where I couldn't be as activist as I might like to be. But, you know, I know some fabulous people, and I was reflecting with Gavin this morning on an experience I had with in a government committee meeting where I felt that the principle that was being applied was just deeply ethically wrong, and the others stood with me. We actually lost it as a vote, but you know, when I put it out, passioned it out, others stood with me. And you go, okay, well, I just didn't want it today. I've got to come back and be better at it next time.
You said something that is deeply ethically wrong.
Yeah.
Where did those ethics come from?
Gosh. you know, I think you get a lot of them from your mum. I know that I get my sense of fairness from my mum. My mum, she's still alive. She's pretty smart, you know. She knows that if she cut an apple, I'd want to have the biggest bit, and my little brother get the smallest bit. So she'd do the Solomon trick. She'd say, okay, so you cut and he chooses. Never seen the precision going into cutting an apple like that.
Do you think that people are, like, coming through school getting that stuff?
Well, you know, you have your moments of despair about it, but I have an absolutely fabulous 18-year-old daughter, of whom I'm incredibly proud. And, you know, she's on every kind of activism there is. She is on so much more activism at 18 than I was, that I feel very hopeful for the planet. And again, meeting Sandy in the weekend and looking at the film and the other film around Glenn and his housing and some of the young people coming through the programs that we're involved in, I think there's some pretty fabulous young people out there.
What's your daughter going to do with that? There's not many programs like the one you teach in where we're actively teaching people, well, or even allowing people to be active.
You know, she's going off to Victoria University next year, and I said, well, so are you going to do politics? And she just looked at me. She said, Dad, you don't think I get enough politics at home? So she's got a love of languages. She's travelled. She's Māori, and so she's going to do some Māori studies and some law and some languages, and whatever she does and learns, she'll make a big difference with her life. I can just see it.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning? A pretty stunning view, I must say.
It is a stunning view, and I leave it in the dark, can you believe it? I belt out of bed before 5, and I'm out of here by 5:30 to go all the way to Henderson. To do the job there. Lovely team of people that I work with. I think that in life people want they want a job worth doing, they want a team worth belonging to, and they want leadership worth following, and 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
That's quite a commute.
It is, yeah, yeah.
Is it a ferry and then train?
Well, it's currently either car or bicycle to the ferry, and then ferry, and then most of the time it's taking the little campaign car that we have because it's got to live in a concrete bunker. And at that time in the morning, I can be in my office by 7, which just gives me a kind of clear early part of the day. When the new trains come, and when we've got a route that doesn't go via Kazakhstan, that might be an option.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Oh, I'm really looking forward to the conference, and that's challenging on a day-by-day basis. And, you know, got one of our young graduates managing that process. Well, it's just fantastic. You know, this young woman, she can take any pile of drivel that I put on the page and turn it into something that looks like a masterpiece. So that's fabulous. After the conference, I'm planning to do a major piece of research in New Zealand on the behaviour of funding organisations and their processes, and how this does it or does not contribute to innovative and sustainable funding relationships. And I'm planning on doing that piece of work for a few years. I'm just finishing a piece of work on the living wage movement and also helping on a project up looking at the South Kaipara Community Economic Development Scheme, which is featuring in the conference. So those are all pretty good.
You're a busy chap, especially with the dancing in the garden stuff.
Oh, yeah, dancing in the garden's a great deal of fun, yeah. Yeah, the filmmaker there, a guy called Baz Cage, an absolute genius, but he just has to look at me in a certain way, and I can't help myself. I've become a total show-off, really.
Yeah,
and the garden's very important to me. I have a great garden here. It's still looking fabulous, but we're entering drought now, so it'll all be dead in a fortnight. Organic food, really, really important to me. Food's really important, you know, sharing it with people.
Okay, 2 more questions, unless I get distracted.
Sure.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by tomorrow morning, what would it be?
Well, my standard reply to that is that every wish I would ever have would come true, but I don't think that's going to wear on this occasion. Gosh. look, we have to fix the climate. That would have to be the top. The two problems we've got to deal with are inequality and the climate. If we get those things knocked off, the rest of it's a piece of cake.
And what's the smallest thing that we could do that would have the biggest impact on either or both of those?
I think if we all really looked at inequality in our society and started having a real discussion about it and saying, no, I don't believe as Kiwis who really want to have a third of children living in poverty. And we've been able to, that's been able to perpetuate because we have not been having the conversation. And we have to have that conversation really, really robustly.
All right. Last question before we get in trouble with the Buddhists. Do you have any advice for our listeners?
Oh, live long and it'll damn your enemies.
Great. You're listening to Sustainable Lands on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. The show was recorded on the 26th of January, 2017. Our guest was John Stansfield. Your hosts are Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts, previous shows on sustainablelands.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or knowwhereyouare.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.